You're listening to Common Ground Conversations on JPR's Jefferson Exchange. I'm Mike Green. This series discusses racialized polarization in politics and structural barriers that have significant impact on society. Our conversation today is about the voting trends of Black and white women. My guest is Sherry Dunn. She's the CEO and principal of ITBOM LLC, a consulting firm specializing in organizational change management, equity and inclusion, leadership, and workforce development. Sherry's a polymath. Having had successful careers as an attorney, a journalist, CEO, professor, funder, and writer, she's also the author of the upcoming book, Qualified, Why Race Still Matters in the Workforce. Sherry, welcome to Common Ground Conversations.
Thank you so much for having me, Mike. I really appreciate it.
Well, I want to get your thoughts about why the majority of Black and white women consistently vote polar opposite of each other. This consistent political dichotomy has real-world applications or implications, particularly for Black women, as you well know. But before we dive into it, we want to hear a little bit more about yourself and the new book you're writing.
Oh, thank you. Well, I'm in Portland, Oregon. I've been here about 9 years. I'm originally from the Midwest, so moving to Oregon and Portland wasn't that big of a shock for me, right? Because I'm from the industrial Midwest and from Milwaukee, Wisconsin. So when I grew up, Milwaukee was a different looking place than it looks today. It had hyper-segregation, you know, predominantly white, a lot of things that reminded me of Portland in that sense. I've lived all over the United States, really, from Texas to California to Chicago to Washington, D.C. So I've had, you know, the unique opportunity to really see in person how people live and manage day to day, and also the unique ways race and racialized conversations show up in different regions. You know what I mean? And
yes.
So my life experience and my consulting really led me to write this book, Qualified, which is really designed to push back against the narrative that Blackness is, by definition, unqualified, and dig a little bit into the historical reasons why we think that is, show how it is showing up in the workplace in the modern day, and give some suggestions and thoughts about what we can do to move forward. So, you know, it really came from just hearing the same stories over and over again in my consulting from people, the ways that they were being spoken to, the things that were happening to them. And this is, you know, from different regions, different areas. So that's what motivated me to write the book. And it's coming out on February 25th, 2025.
Well, I'm looking forward to your insights in our conversation today. The issue we're discussing in this series is about Black and white women and their voting trends. So here's some data for you, Sherry. Mm-hmm. 157 million voters registered in the 2020 presidential election, and white voters represented 71%, according to the Pew Research Center. Some more data from the Pew Research is that among the white voters, white women are the largest demographic voting bloc in America at 61 million. And by comparison, the entire population of all non-white voters, both men and women, is only 46 million. Mm-hmm. But here's the issue we want to focus on today. The largest voting bloc of white voters are white women at 61 million, and the largest voting bloc of non-white voters are Black women at about 12 million. And in the last two presidential elections, an overwhelming majority of Black women voted for Democratic candidates and causes, while a majority of white women in both elections voted polar opposite. In fact, this trend has held true for 15 of the last 17 presidential elections, and it may still continue in this year's election, despite a convicted criminal running as the presumptive Republican nominee. So, Sherry, why do you think 90% of Black women vote in one direction in each election, while a majority of white women consistently vote polar opposite?
Well, I mean, first of all, just to pull apart those numbers a little bit, I mean, I think that 40-some percent of white women don't, right? So they don't vote that way, just to say, because otherwise, you know, there'd be no alternative party.
That's true.
Yeah, but I think it has a lot to do with perceptions of power and pragmatism. I think for Black women, our decisions have always been pragmatic. I frequently think about it as what's worse and what's worster, which is not a word.
Okay.
But, you know, what's worse and what's worster. And so, you know, we have had to figure out pragmatically what is going to do the least damage and what is going to do the most damage. So, there is this prevailing notion in some quarters that Black people in general and Black women are just, you know, automatons who vote Democratic because they see a D, and that they're not making any kind of informed thought or judgment, when in fact they are. Black women overwhelmingly supported Hillary Clinton, and many Black women did not like Hillary Clinton, but they saw a pragmatic choice, meaning they saw that there was a clear and present danger with one candidate and there wasn't with the other. Now, they didn't have to love Hillary Clinton, but they understood what the problems would be if she was not elected, which we now see coming to fruition. And I think for Black women, it's what is going to, I think Black women have this thing where it may, let's say there's a well-off Black woman who's financially, the policies of another candidate might be better for her. Black women tend to look more at the collective. What is it that our community needs? What is it that the country needs? They tend to be much more collective thinkers, I think, from a historical perspective. And so from that point, from that vantage point, they sometimes might even make decisions that might not immediately economically be maybe best for them, but they think more long term. I think when it comes for white women, the perception of power issue comes into play. And I use that because truth of the matter is that sexism and patriarchy are never going to empower women, white or Black women. But there is a perception of power that is really important to a lot of white women.
Isn't there a proximity to power as well?
Yeah, there's proximity to power and then a perception of power, right? So I have proximity power through white men, and I perceive that that power extends to me, when in fact it really doesn't. There's all this data about workforce harassment and you know, all these issues that go on with women at work. But there is a perception that because I have proximity to power, I am going to be protected. And so it's more of a frequently an I-based decision and then a closer to home decision. Obviously, white women, just like Black women, have children. They have sons and daughters. And so some people may see themselves promoting and sustaining white supremacy for their children, whether consciously or unconsciously. So it's a more, this is what's best for me and my family, as opposed to this is what's best for the collective. Does that make sense?
It does. Do they realize that their positioning at the polls has consequences?
I think some people do. I think, again, there is this illusion of power, right? An illusion of safety and proximity. There are plenty of white women I know out there who are fighting tooth and nail against the rollback of women's rights. But there's a group of women, you know, who are in positions of power who seem unable to follow this line of reasoning that in taking away rights from other women, it'll eventually come for you. You know, that poem, you know, I wasn't a machinist, they came for machinist, I wasn't, you know, right. They're not following that line of reasoning all the way through, or they erroneously believe that somehow they will be protected, right? But this has come up in red states with women who are conservative and who are anti-abortion, and yet who have found themselves in life or death situations that they weren't anticipating. Well, how they weren't anticipating, I don't know, but they weren't anticipating this was going to actually impact them. Do you see what I'm saying?
I do. This is Common Ground Conversations on the Jefferson Exchange. I'm Mike Green. I'm speaking with Sherry Dunn, CEO of the consulting firm ITBOM and author of the upcoming book, Qualified, Why Race Still Matters in the Workforce. So, Sherry, as a Black woman, when you vote, what are some of the top priorities for you? And what are some of the common concerns for Black and white women that you believe can cut across the divide?
Well, for me, it is human rights and civil rights are like primary right now. They matter more than anything because economics are clearly very important, but without human rights or civil rights, the economics don't matter to me because I'm not going to have access to that, right? And I include environmental as part of economic and human rights, right? So someone who is going to ensure the continuation of a robust defense of economic, human rights and civil rights is a top mine for me right now. And because I think we are in danger. I think, and you, I know, Mike, you know your history. You are the history guy. You know how this all connects. And, you know, for me, I think we are at a time in our history that is as precarious as we were at the end of Reconstruction, right, after slavery. And what happened was 100-plus years of suffering, I call it, under Jim Crow, right? I think we're at a very dangerous tipping point where the rights of women and people of color are in real and present danger, not like theoretical, not hysterical, but real danger. So those are the two biggest things for me. And everything else flows from that. If our human dignity and our civil rights are respected, we can have a robust economy. If we allow people to participate in a fair game, we can have an economic system that works. But if we are going to have what the Germans called a Herrenvolk democracy, which is a democracy for white Christian men and nobody else, well, this is not going to work. That's not a sustainable system. That's a system that is going to be fraught with violence and anger and limitations. And so I don't want us to go that way. And so that is pushing on me. I think for a lot of women, black and white, this human right of reproductive freedom. And like I said, this is sliding. Now we have birth control pills. Now we have other things coming online. And to me, this is about hemming white women up. I mean, I do think it's about all women, but I feel Roe v. Wade and the attacks on birth control are really aimed at undermining white women in particular and their stability in the workplace and in society. Because if you take away a woman's ability to manage when she has children, you effectively X her out of economic opportunities because she can't, you know, you can't manage that way. And so I think a lot of women are beginning to see that. But then I think there, you know, are women, we talked about just a minute ago, proximity to power and illusion of power, who right. really think they're fighting for some return and restoration to a white dominant society that they think is going to be better for them somehow, which was not. You know, the 60s was not great. The 50s, the 1850s, the 1900s, these were not great times for women of any sort. But you have people who think that.
Well, Sherry, we're running out of time, but I want to ask you this. If the majorities of both black and white women voted in alignment with their collective best interests, since the majorities of all non-white women are already voting in alignment with black women, we're just missing the majority of white women. If the majority of white women were to collectively vote in alignment with the majority of black women, could that swing the pendulum of power in a way that benefits all women?
That's the main point, is that the idea that this is just about benefiting black women or other women of color is a fallacy. Women, if we work together to scale our economic and social power, we can change the tide, not just in politics, but in the workplace. We can demand childcare in the workplace, which the United States had in the 40s during World War II because they needed women to work. We together can work collectively toward things that we need, which will also be better for society. And it isn't an either or choice with black or white women, but we need to break down these barriers that have us thinking that we're separate, that we have separate agendas. And this proximity to power and this illusion of that power, that has to be broken so that white women see that's not, the path is with other women. The path is with male allies. The path is with people who see your humanity and civil rights, not people who are ultimately going to turn on you too, because, you know, this is not for you. You know what I'm saying? So I absolutely think that that is the path to power. And I encourage and hope that communities can have these conversations as you're trying to do.
And we'll have to leave it there. Unfortunately, that's all the time we have for this episode. Thank you, Sherry, for an insightful conversation.
Thank you. Thanks for having me.
You've been listening to Common Ground Conversations on JPR's Jefferson Exchange. You can find this program and more on our website at jeffexchange.org or subscribe to the Jefferson Exchange on Apple, Spotify, or wherever you get your podcasts. I'll post this conversation on LinkedIn at amikegreen2. That's A. Mike Green and the number 2. Thank you for listening to Common Ground Conversations.
And when the Jefferson Exchange continues, food for thought about food and meat and living without it. A vegan wrote The Good Eater. You'll hear from Nina Gilboa on the JX after a break.